On the evening of 15th July, we made the acquaintance of Kawe Nyanga, the chief of the district on the south bank of the Lukuga Creek near the mouth. He remembered Cameron distinctly, described his person and dress, and informed me that he had accompanied him to the reeds, which he said blocked the head of the creek. At the time of his visit, he said, pointing at the same time to a long line of breakers which marked 3/4 of the broad entrance from the lake to the creek, there were 2 spits of sand running from either side of the mouth, and there was a small fishing settlement on the one which projected from our side. As they were now covered up, he entertained a suspicion that Cameron had dropped some powerful medicine which had brought on this destruction. If one white man had brought so much mischief, what might not 2 white men do? In his book, Through the Dark Continent, journalist Henry Stanley describes the suspicion that his fellow British explorer, Verney Lovett Cameron, encountered during their travels through East Africa in the 1870s. How did the visits of Stanley and Cameron and others affect the history of East Africa? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did the continent's history prior to the 19th century affect the conquests and colonization that followed? Were there benefits to colonization? Is African nationalism a political force in East Africa or a relic of colonialism? Our guest is Neil Kodish, professor of history at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I think a lot of Americans end up not knowing much about Africa because the way school works, you get a year of American history followed by a year of European history and then back to American history, and Africa often is not center stage. I'm wondering if you could start by telling us some of the most common misconceptions that you encounter when you're talking about East Africa.
Sure. There are some really deep-rooted misconceptions about Africa and African history that stem in large part back to the early period of the slave trade and how that informed ideas about Africa and particularly about African barbarism and cannibalism and ideas like that. And these persist very strongly, not necessarily on a conscious level, but they are so sort of deeply embedded in media portrayals of Africa that they really affect students and students' ideas when they come into the classroom. And I found that one of the sort of most common misconceptions among students when they first begin to learn about Africa, at least at the university level, is the idea that Africans all lived in tribes and continue to live in tribes. And that the idea here is that these tribes are these sort of tightly bound units, and they're almost unthinking in the sense that the way that tribes are often portrayed, both in the media and development circles, is that they're so deeply rooted in tradition that they become an impediment to progress and modernization. And the idea is that if only Africans could let go of their deeply held traditions, which are holding them back, then Africa and the countries which they live in the continent more broadly would be able to progress or become more modern, in the words of development workers. And embedded in this particular idea is the notion that Africans have very strongly held traditions, and they're unyielding, they're unwilling to sort of let go of the grip of tradition on their lives, and that these traditions have always been there, they haven't changed over hundreds of years, and that they will continue to persist for the near future.
And how would you distinguish your interest, let's say, in East Africa as opposed to other parts of Africa? What makes that particular part of the continent different and intriguing for you?
Well, I mean, there's different ways to define what constitutes East Africa depending on your discipline or depending on the political context you're working in. For most historians of Africa, I would say when they talk about East Africa, they're generally referring to what are today the countries of Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. And the reason why sort of those 3 countries constitute East Africa is largely a result of the colonial period, where those were all subjects of British rule. Tanzania was first a German colony, but after World War I became a British colony. But they were all part of sort of an East African confederation that was held together in large part by British rule. The people living in these countries, depending on where you're looking at in each country, do share some cultural similarities and some sort of shared historical background. But in the case of Uganda, the folks living at least in southern Uganda also share deep historical roots with people living in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, in what is today Rwanda, Burundi, the western part of Tanzania. So it's very difficult to sort of to define what constitutes East Africa. Some folks might want to include Eritrea and the Horn of Africa, Somalia,
right,
Ethiopia.
More of an Arab influence.
Or at least where folks have sort of a long, at least in Ethiopia, have long-standing connections to parts of the world sort of outside of East Africa. So it depends on sort of the particular context in which you're talking about East Africa. For my purposes, I tend to look at Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania.
And what drew you to the study of East African history to begin with? Why that?
Right. When I began graduate school at Northwestern University, I knew I wanted to study East Africa because of my undergraduate studies at Pomona College. I had studied abroad in Kenya and ended up writing a senior thesis on a particular aspect of colonial Kenyan history. So I knew I wanted to focus on East Africa just because it was familiar. I had spent time there. I enjoyed it. And in looking around for a master's thesis, you get to graduate school, you're scrambling around for a topic to write on. You know, Kenyan history is pretty well developed. It's a lot more crowded than other places. So I was looking around for a particular topic, and I ended up writing on the rapid spread of Christianity in this kingdom called Buganda, which is in what is today Uganda, in the late 19th and the early 20th century. And in the course of writing that master's thesis about the spread of Christianity, I became really dissatisfied with the pre-colonial period, sort of how might explanations, historical explanations from the pre-colonial period, inform our understanding of what happened in the early colonial period. And there just wasn't enough for me to go on there, and therefore I sort of decided to develop my interest in pre-colonial East Africa, and particularly Uganda, based on that experience.
What were the conditions in pre-colonial East Africa that made it, let's say, ripe for colonization?
I don't think there was anything specific or particular to East Africa in this respect that made it ripe for colonization. I think when historians first started to look at the period of conquest and the implementation of colonial rule, they tended to sort of create these very simplistic binary stories where you had a group of Europeans come in and a group of Africans on the other side. And Africans either collaborated with Europeans or they resisted European conquest. And in this case, sort of resistance became the model of scholarship, right, where people were looking for African forms of resistance that eventually became resistance several decades later to colonial rule in general. In the last 15 or 20 years or so, this resistance model has really begun to break down. And what historians have pointed out is that you really can't understand the process of conquest and colonization without really looking at what was happening, particularly over the course of the 19th century in East Africa. So in other words, it wasn't just one unified group of Africans that confronted a unified group of Europeans. There were internal divisions within African communities. And if you want to talk about, to use your phrase, what made it ripe, there were particular people who saw an advantage in sort of aligning themselves with particular European interests in an effort to intervene in their particular local disputes within their communities.
It's the same thing we saw in this, let's say, on this continent with the Native Americans and the Europeans coming. Some groups of Native Americans had a vested interest in welcoming the Europeans because of their power and the fact they could tip the balance of power between competing groups of Native Americans. Same thing in Africa.
Exactly, yeah. And in both, sort of the model is the same in both colonial contexts. The story is a lot more complicated than in the case of Africa, literally black and white. And of course, to say this is also, you also need to sort of note here that many of the changes that were taking place in the 19th century in East Africa that led to a situation in which particular groups of Africans might want to align themselves or at least share interests with particular groups of Europeans, these changes had to do with the increasing effect of Europeans on the continent prior to the actual period of formal conquest and colonization. So in the case of East Africa, for instance, the Indian Ocean slave trade, in which slaves were taken from parts of Central East Africa towards the coast and then made their way to various parts of the Indian Ocean world or to North Africa, and also many of them remained in East Africa as slaves. This had an enormous impact on the in terms of the conditions that Europeans encountered when they arrived in the places in the interior of East Africa.
Before we get to the Europeans in that encounter, if we go way back, you know, most of us are familiar with ancient Egypt and the hieroglyphics and the pyramids and all that. If you go to East Africa, what evidence do you have, actual concrete signs of an ancient history?
This is an interesting and a complicated question. One of the challenges that historians of East Africa face revolve around sources. For most places in the interior, the coast is a bit different because you had periods of contact with Persians and Arabs
Record
and
keepers.
The Portuguese, and you also have people writing on the coast in Arabic script but in Swahili language from a very early period beginning in the 16th and 17th century. But for most places in the interior, the first written documentation we have is beginning only in the mid-19th century. So, of course, this presents a methodological challenge for historians. How do you write about an earlier period, given the fact that your first documents are from the mid-19th century? And the way that historians of pre-colonial East Africa tackle this challenge is through a sort of a multi-layered methodology that involves looking at historical linguistics, archaeology, comparative ethnography, as well as whatever written documentation you have when used appropriately to write about the past. So we have an archaeological record. I mean, we have evidence of some of the earliest human beings in East Africa. But sort of moving a little bit more forward in time, we have archaeological evidence about the first sort of instances of specialized cattle pastoralism, the first evidence of land-intensive banana farming. Ironworking in the Great Lakes region in East Africa is probably the earliest evidence of ironworking in East Africa, which obviously had an enormous impact on the type of societies that emerged once people discovered how to smelt iron.
How old is that?
Ironworking goes back at least to about 1000 BC. Most of the areas of earliest settlement in the Great Lakes region, for instance, are at least amongst Bantu speakers, which is one particular group of speakers in East Africa, is to about 500 BC. But there were other folks living there for, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years before that. So we have all that kind of evidence in the archaeological record. And then when you combine that with evidence from historical linguistics, where we compare the many languages spoken in the region to write stories about the histories of people who once spoke those languages, you can write really rich, detailed histories of the pre-colonial period, but you have to be trained in how to do so. It's a little bit unconventional and a bit unusual for historians working in other fields and other time periods.
What actually was going on in East Africa before European colonialism? Before the, let's say, even say the first European contact?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends where you're looking at. In the Great Lakes region, for instance, which includes what is today southern Uganda and Rwanda and Burundi, western Tanzania, parts of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, we see beginning around 1600 the emergence of several well-known kingdoms. So, for instance, Rwanda was initially a kingdom that then became a colony and an independent nation. Uganda, which is what is today Uganda, was one of the better-known kingdoms during the period. You also had kingdoms in western Uganda, Bunyoro and Ankole. In other parts of East Africa, such as in central Kenya, you had the emergence of much more decentralized communities. And these have often been difficult for historians to make sense of initially, at least beginning in the 1960s, because their models of political organization were so different from what we expect from a European context. They were so unfamiliar to try to figure out how societies could hang together in the absence of political centralization, that we wanted to fit them into these more conventional models coming from a European context. But that's sort of part of the challenge of doing pre-colonial African history. And on the coast, of course, it was a little bit of a different situation because, as mentioned earlier, we had influences from Persia. We had influences from the Arabian Peninsula. We had the Portuguese arriving in the area beginning in around the 16th century. But there, what historians usually focus on until recently is the emergence of these well-known Swahili city-states, which are some early examples of urban cosmopolitan East African communities, and they've been very attractive for historians to look at, particularly for archaeologists. I think it's a lot easier to get funding for an archaeological project if you say you're going to excavate this sort of amazing urban site rather than the associated rural sites to figure out what people were eating and what sorts of agricultural processes people were engaging in.
Now, Swahili, is that in itself sort of a pastiche language that's influenced by outside influences?
I think actually that is one of the, getting back to our earlier comments, one of the misconceptions about East African history is this idea that Swahili is somehow a combination of an African language or Arabic or some kind of pidgin, but really with an Arabic basis. Swahili is a Bantu language, which is one of the major language families in Africa. People in Africa from southern Nigeria all the way to South Africa and everyone in between speak one of many hundreds of Bantu languages. Swahili is one of them in its morphology, in its phonology, in its syntax. It is clearly a Bantu language. It has borrowings in terms of vocabulary from Arabic, and quite a number of them, usually words having to do with reading and writing and arithmetic and commerce, the things that Africans learned from Arabs. But these are actually quite late, these borrowings, beginning only in the 1700s. I mean, we have some earlier borrowings, but the majority of them come from after 1700. And these are some of the things that historical linguists look at, which types of words were borrowed into a language at which particular times. And they must refer to interactions between different groups of people reflected in the linguistic record. But Swahili is a quintessential Bantu African language with borrowings from other languages.
And just happens to be the language choice for early writers?
It was because Swahili, as sort of an indigenous language, as a mother tongue, is spoken on the coast. And this was the area of interaction between the Portuguese and Africans and Arabs and Africans and Persians and Africans. So the first Africans in East Africa to learn how to write were on the coast. Europeans and other outsiders did not make their way into the interior until considerably later in the mid-19th century. So Arabic was the first script that Africans on the coast learned, but they wrote in Arabic script in Swahili. Mm-hmm. Which is a situation you also find oftentimes in West Africa, where Arabic is used as the script to write West African languages in a considerably earlier period, but it's a similar phenomenon.
What can you tell us about religion prior to the arrival of Christian missionaries? I'm assuming, too, that there are burial sites mm-hmm. and places of worship and things in the archaeological record that help you tell what kind of religious practices were going on.
Sure. There's a lot in the archaeological record, but there's also more in, I would say, the oral traditions from the region. And this is an area which I've done some work, and I guess the first thing I should say is that religion is a somewhat misleading and problematic concept when talking about other places in the world like pre-colonial Africa. In many respects, religion itself as a concept, as a sort of a mode of understanding, is an imposition, I think, from outside onto an African context. And what happened in the colonial period was that many of the missionaries who first arrived in East Africa, they were looking for ways to convert Africans, to teach them about Christianity. And one of the things they first had to do was to identify what Africans' religions were in order to sort of have a conversation, right, comparing Christianity with other religions. So they did research. Some of them wrote ethnographies. And if you read some of these early ethnographies from the late 19th and early 20th century, they'll have a chapter on, you know, politics, a chapter on social organization, and a chapter on what they're calling religion or superstition or witchcraft, something like that. And if you sort of read these closely, what they're describing is actually not anything that actually existed in reality. They've taken bits and pieces of information that they have collected and put them together to constitute what they are then calling religion. But you'd be hard-pressed to find an African at the time describing any mode of thought or way of living in those particular terms. Many scholars still continue to use the term religion to describe these sorts of practices, but for the reasons I've just described, I think is problematic. What I tend to do, building on the work of some other scholars, is instead of talking about religion, to talk about what I call public healing. And public healing is just the idea that communities can suffer the collective analogs of illnesses. So when many East African communities in the talk about sort of problems within their communities and what we might consider to be political problems, they use the language of health and healing to describe these problems. But it's not the it's a little bit different from conventional ideas of health and healing, which are relationships between an individual patient and a healer. These are, you know, these are what we might call diseases that afflict and affect entire communities. And there are particular people who were better positioned than others to cure those communities, whether it be from famine or warfare or a particular disease, however sort of constructed, not necessarily a biological entity. And this is what has sort of passed for religion in most studies. But again, religion, is about when people speak about religion, they're usually speaking about belief. And this is not what East Africans were talking about. They're talking about finding practical solutions to problems in the material world. And these often involved public healers who could provide cures for communities on a collective level. And we have lots of evidence in oral traditions of, particularly from the Great Lakes region, of folks who are these public healers who are also political figures who really play a directive role in getting communities to live in healthy ways and in preserving sort of continuous well-being for the communities over which they preside. And these are the figures who are usually called religious leaders. I tend to call them instead public healers.
And we will look further at the history of East Africa, both pre-colonial and colonial and post-colonial too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Neil Kodish, and we're looking at the history, the early history for now, of East Africa and finding out that, of course, these things are more complicated than they first look. We have these interesting, they seem to be very loose-knit social structures in East Africa, not even religion that we can determine and not political centers either. How does that kind of a culture then interact with outside cultures that are suddenly interested in putting down footholds in East Africa?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated question. One of the things that happened once you have the arrival of European missionaries followed by European colonial officials and European military figures is that, as mentioned earlier, there were particular figures or groups of people within East African communities in the mid to late 19th century who were in a position to take advantage of the sort of arrival of Europeans. And one of the things that happened is that in certain places, such as Uganda, when missionaries arrived, you had Africans converting relatively quickly and in large numbers to Christianity. And the question... One of the questions scholars have asked is,
would be why?
Why are Africans converting so quickly in particular places in such large numbers to Christianity? And in looking at this situation in Uganda, which is one of the sort of best known studies cases of this, initially scholars sort of called this a religious revolution. And the idea was that the folks who were converting to Christianity in southern Uganda, particularly along the areas around the northwest shores of Lake Victoria, they had completely abandoned earlier ideas, and they were really taken by this Christian idea, and they provided them with a way to make themselves politically palatable to Europeans. And after that, they could then use that position, their sort of newfound positions within this emerging colonial structure, right, for their own benefits, and to expand their political realm of their kingdoms, in this case, to other areas. So they could actually increase the size of their kingdoms by working with Europeans and by presenting themselves as Christians. In more recent years, scholars have been interested in sort of looking at potential continuities rather than viewing this as a complete break as a disjuncture, to look at the way that Africans incorporated Christianity into their lives.
How was Christianity compatible
exactly.
with
what and, of course,
had
language had a big part in this. If you think about European missionaries coming in with copies of the Bible in either English or French or another language, and then trying to explain these things to Africans, some of the missionaries knew African languages. Many of them did not, so oftentimes they relied on African intermediaries to translate for them. But there are some concepts that are very difficult to translate into other languages. There's some strange ideas in Christianity, as there are in many religions. And what some scholars are sort of doing is to go back and to retranslate those sort of ideas and to look at them, what those ideas might have meant in African languages in that particular context. And when you retranslate all of those things, what comes out on the other end is something very different from what we might call Christianity.
As I say, lost in translation. You know, the Lord is my shepherd probably wouldn't translate.
Exactly, or the Virgin Mary or the devil or, you know, concepts like that. And many of these ideas you can see resonate with African ideas when viewed through the lens of the particular African language that you're dealing with. And through this, you can see much better why it is Christianity became appealing for Africans and how then, and again, remember, many of these communities actually suffered greatly as a result of some of the changes that had taken place over the course of the second half of the 19th century, particularly the increase, the rise of the Indian Ocean slave trade, and some of the sort of atrocities that accompanied colonial conquest. And they were sort of looking for ways to rebuild their communities. And one of the ways that they did this was by using Christianity for their own purposes in an effort, one, to rebuild their communities, but two, to really find their way in this sort of rapidly changing world inflected with European colonialism.
So the Europeans were the first to try to colonize East Africa. The Persians and the Arabs were really there just for trade and travel back and forth?
Yeah, there was no direct contact between Africans living in the interior and Europeans and Arabs and Persians until the mid-19th century. You had indirect contact where trade goods would make their way from the coast to places in the interior as far as, you know, sometimes 1,000 miles into the interior. We have evidence, for instance, of archaeological evidence of glass beads from China all the way in the 16th century in the interior of East Africa. But these were goods that were handed, you know, from community to community rather than someone coming from the coast all the way to the interior. This didn't happen until the mid-19th century. And when Arabs did settle on the Swahili coast from very early periods, beginning, most folks think, in the 10th or 11th century, initially, Europeans, sort of colonial officials and later scholars in the sort of early part of the second half of the 20th century, they viewed these Swahili urban cosmopolitan towns as the result of Arab colonization because there's no way in their minds that Africans could have created these cosmopolitan, urban, sort of sophisticated cultures. And that has been really turned on its head in the last 30 years or so, 20 or 30 years. And these were clearly African communities. And when you did have an Arab presence in them, it was that Arabs were incorporated into these African communities rather than the other way around. It wasn't until the 18th and 19th centuries that with the establishment of the capital of the Omani Empire in Zanzibar, an island off the coast of Tanzania, that you really begin to see a large Arab presence having an effect in East Africa.
Back to the idea of religion. You know, you mentioned that term maybe is a little misleading. You were using healing instead or sort of healers and so on. But presumably the African communities prior to the Christian missionaries had a distinct sense of who their god or gods were.
Right.
And often when you have the encounter with Christianity, you have some kind of a hybrid almost that can happen where you're taking original gods and fusing it with Christianity. I don't get a sense from what you said yet of what the belief would have been in various areas of East Africa in terms of how the world was created, who created it, who the gods were, and how they needed to be sort of appeased.
Right. This, of course, will vary by community. But in general, in most communities in East Africa, there was the idea of a creator. Whether you want to call it a god or a spirit or some other sort of entity, there was the idea of the creator, someone who was responsible for creating the world, but then really played no role in the world after that. In most communities, the most relevant entities, spiritual entities, were what are often called ancestral ghosts or the spirits of ancestors. And the idea here was that there was a direct continuity between what we conventionally call the material realm and the spiritual realm. And the idea was that when people died, their spirit or their life force, or sometimes in English we call it their soul, continued to exist. And it could embody other people in the living world, for either good reasons or for bad purposes. And as a result of this, most East African communities had designed a variety of different types of practices to appease their ancestors, right? To make sure that the memory of their ancestors continued to be perpetuated in the material world. And if ancestors were no longer appeased, if their memory was, if they were forgotten, this was a sign of bad things to come, because these ancestors could sort of make their presence felt in the material world in ways that would be destructive. So there are a variety of different types of practices, but all designed around the same idea, that it's actually ancestors who are responsible for the continued well-being of communities, and therefore East Africans designed practices to appease ancestors to ensure this continued well-being. And in this respect, the role of elders, who were, you know, somewhere in between junior folks and ancestors, became really important, because they became the reservoirs, the communicators. Sometimes they were spirit mediums. Sometimes they just directed these practices. Sometimes they were priests at particular shrines. But part of their role was to make, because they knew that they would soon become ancestors themselves. And one of the things they were sort of concerned with was making sure that once they died, that their life force had someone to embody and that they would not be forgotten in this world.
A big factor in the, I'll call it, clash between Europeans and Native Americans was disease, and the fact that it was really a one-way street, except for syphilis. It was a one-way street going from Europe to North America, and devastating, of course, communities and therefore social and political structures. How did that play out in Africa as the Europeans started coming into East Africa?
Disease wasn't quite as devastating in East Africa as it was in Native American communities, partially because Native American communities had long been out of contact with the disease environments that characterized the so-called Old World, whereas East Africans had long been in contact. And in fact, up until the mid-19th century, you could make the argument that it was the particular disease environments in East Africa and in sort of sub-Saharan Africa more broadly that actually prevented Europeans from making their way into the interior, because Europeans suffered incredibly high mortality rates from tropical diseases such as malaria and yellow fever, whereas most East Africans and folks living in sub-Saharan Africa more generally had built up some sort of immunity to these diseases. Not full immunity, but if you contract these diseases as a child, sometimes several times in the case of malaria, and you survive, you build up a degree of resistance that makes it much less likely to die from these diseases as an adult. Whereas when you're exposed to them as an adult for the first time, you're much more likely to die as a result. And it was in the mid-19th century that you had a series of technological innovations that allowed Europeans to develop sort of various forms of prophylaxis against these diseases that then allowed them to move into the interior and begin the process of contact and colonization, and eventually the implementation of colonial rule. With that said, there were particular diseases in East Africa that did ravage certain populations because of recent introductions. We're still actually studying this, and we for some of them we don't know as much as we probably should at this point. But for instance, smallpox really ravaged certain communities in East Africa, and there's a debate about whether smallpox actually existed in East Africa and other parts of the continent prior to Europeans, or if it wasn't introduced by Europeans, or perhaps if there was a different strain prior to when Europeans arrived. But it clearly devastated East African, particularly East African communities during the early colonial period. Again, it's up for debate whether this was a new disease or not. If you sort of subscribe to the idea that this was not a new disease, then you attribute the sort of devastation, the devastating effects of smallpox during this period, to the idea that communities became destabilized, and hunger became a problem. Famine resulted as a emerged as a result of colonial conquest, and as communities are moving more and moving into particular areas where they can sort of combat their famine and mixing more, they're more susceptible, right, to outbreaks, and that will affect larger numbers of people because of increased population movements and increasing density of populations in particular areas.
And what is known about I guess, the motives of the Europeans, whether it's the Portuguese or the British or the German or whoever went in there, what were they most after in terms of natural resources, and what did they most want to exploit the area for?
Yeah, I mean, there are a variety of different ideas in terms of explaining ideological or material motivations for conquest. I'll begin on an ideological level. One of the justifications for European conquest was, and one of sort of the largest ironies in African history, to stamp out the slave trade, right? The idea was that when Stanley and Livingston traveled through these areas and others like them traveled through these areas in East Africa, they wrote home to their communities back in Britain and other places in Europe about the devastating effects of slavery as practiced in East Africa and how Europeans were obligated to stamp out the slave trade as part of the effort to civilize Africans. Of course, the irony in all this is that the sort of the increasing rates of enslavement and the increasing use of slaves within East Africa were a direct result of European demand for slaves prior to the official abolition of the slave trade. But this was really one of the sort of major ideological justifications or motivations for colonial conquest. Of course, people usually refer to the three C's: commerce, Christianity, and civilization. So Christianity would be part of what I just described. One of the ways to civilize Africans was to make them Christians. And of course, part of this involved commercial enterprises, right? To create Africans, sort of consumers who wanted products, and this would embed them in this larger global colonial world and make them more dependent on these on larger structures that were sort of went hand in hand with colonial rule. In terms of actual resources, this depended on where you were. Some places were naturally rich in minerals and other resources, but in the case of East Africa, you had some pockets of gold and also other mineral deposits, but most places actually weren't that wealthy in natural resources. So what happened in most places in East Africa was there was a real push in the colonial period for the development of cash crops. One of the sort of tenets of colonialism from the perspective of the British, of the colonial office, was that colonies had to pay for themselves. And one of the ways you got colonies to pay for themselves was by getting Africans to produce cash crops that were in demand in Europe and elsewhere in the world. So in central Kenya, for instance, where the so-called White Highlands, where you had large European settlement, the reasons Europeans settled in these areas was because they were higher up, they were cooler, they were less malarial. So they were good places for Europeans to live. But because of these environmental conditions, they were also really good places to grow coffee. Mm-hmm. So Europeans acquired large plantations. They wanted to grow coffee, but they needed a labor force to help them grow coffee. So this led to the creation of a reserve system where Africans were placed in designated reserves and taxes were imposed on them. And the only way to pay off your taxes was by going to work on a European plantation where they were growing coffee. In Uganda, you had a different cash crop. In southern Uganda, the big cash crop in addition to coffee was cotton. There you didn't have as much European settlement as you did in a place like Kenya. So instead, you had African chiefs and other figures of authority from within African communities who, as a result of some of the processes that I described earlier, benefited from colonial rule, acquired large private land holdings with titles, something which didn't exist before. And the people who were formerly clients turned into tenants who were, again, taxes were imposed on them, and the way you paid off your taxes was by providing labor on colonial cotton plantations, or also coffee was another big cash crop in this region. And as a result of this, the productive basis of African economies changed dramatically. Cash crops are particularly dangerous to rely upon because you're subject to the market. The fluctuations of the market are, in many respects, outside of the control of producers. You also don't eat cash crops. So oftentimes what happened was, whereas people used to be growing food that they ate and then trading the surplus for other products not in their area, now they're dependent on a crop that you can't eat and that is also subject to fluctuations in the market that are out of your control, and you just become more dependent on this sort of global economy than you once were.
I always associate Zanzibar with spices.
Yeah.
Was that a native and indigenous thing, or was that also a kind of European phenomenon?
That actually predates the sort of formal European presence in Zanzibar. Zanzibar became a protectorate of Britain in 1890. But the cloves, for which Zanzibar is most well known, it's not an indigenous crop. It comes from Malaysia. We don't know exactly how or, in fact, when the crop made its way to Zanzibar and other places in East Africa. But we know by the beginning of the 19th century, people were already sort of harvesting cloves in Zanzibar. This is connected to what I was talking about earlier with the increase in the sort of volume of the Indian Ocean slave trade over the course of the 19th century. When Europeans outlawed the slave trade in incremental stages in East Africa, initially they outlawed the trade in slaves outside of the continent, right, to European Christian countries, but you could still trade slaves to other parts of the Indian Ocean world, and you could still move slaves from the mainland to the islands and move slaves within East Africa. And eventually, in the 1870s, they outlawed the actual movement of slaves in East Africa. But each step when slave, sort of each incremental step outlawing various aspects of the trade in slaves made slaves a lot cheaper for internal consumption because
suddenly,
the market,
demand was down.
The demand was down, so slaves became cheaper, which led to their increased use in East Africa. This is another irony in the sort of in the abolition of the slave trade. It's that it actually led to the increased use of slaves within East Africa, and particularly on Zanzibar Island, slaves were used in massive numbers for the production and harvesting of cloves European market.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The real advantage, the real attraction for Africa then, for Europeans, is that it was so much closer. In other words, you didn't have to go to America to get cotton. You didn't have to go to Malaysia to get cloves. You didn't have to go to China maybe to get something else. It was much closer to home, much more easily produced and more cheaply, I would guess, given the labor pool.
Exactly, yeah. It also, of course, brought particular political problems that eventually became difficult, if not impossible, to control. But this was part of the idea for European colonization, particularly after the First World War and then the Second World War, where the colonies were viewed in many respects as a resource for the development of Europe right after the devastating effects of these wars. Not only were colonies then meant to pay for themselves, but they were actually designed in part to help rebuild Europe, particularly after World War II.
We're going to look more at the history of East Africa leading up to today when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Neil Kodish, and we are talking about the history of East Africa. I think historians are often asked the sort of relevance question, what good does learning about pre-colonial East Africa have? What good does it do today? How does it help us understand 20th or 21st century Africa? How would you answer that?
I think there are a variety of ways you could answer that. One of the I think most important ones is sort of building on an argument made about 10 years ago by a really well-known historian of East Africa named Steve Fireman, who actually taught for many years at the University of Wisconsin. He wrote an article in which he surveyed some of the literature on colonial Africa. And what he noted was there's some really great scholarship on the colonial period, case studies of particular places, and they tend to write about hybridity. So the idea was that you had some African element coming in combined with a European element in the colonial period, and they mixed together, and the result was some sort of new hybrid society. And he noted these are really sort of wonderful studies, some of the best scholarship we have on colonial Africa. But the problem that he pointed to was what he called the problem of representation. If you wanted to write a more regional history, let's say, of East Africa, by combining these various kind of micro-studies of hybridity, the only thing that they seemed to share in common was their European referent. So, for instance, they would all share Christianity in general, or they would all share the spread of capitalism in general. And if you put them all together to write a regional narrative going across the 20th century, what you had was the European referent, and it ended up in a narrative of ideas and practices flowing from Europe into Africa, which is clearly problematic for historians of Africa. And the obvious solution that he presented in this case was to develop similar, what he called meta-narratives, sort of these large-scale narratives, but grounded in Africa. And if you had those narratives grounded in Africa, that perhaps might change the way we look at this period of colonial conquest and perhaps the whole course of 20th century African history. So just to go back to our earlier conversation, rather than a story about the spread of Christianity, let's say, it would become a story of what happened to these deeply embedded ideas of public healing once Christianity arrived, and how Christianity was incorporated and into much older notions, sometimes changing them. Sometimes you see continuity, sometimes you see rupture. And this, I think, is really sort of important for looking at the significance of studying pre-colonial African history for the 20th century. And it becomes particularly important even in the contemporary period, because one of the debates is what happened to these African ideas over the course of the 20th century. Did European colonialism just completely destroy these previously vibrant traditions, or their continuities, or some combination? But we can't really comment on that without having these deeper pre-colonial African histories. You can't say what changed unless you have an understanding of what was there prior to these sometimes dramatic transformations.
Well, we look at the map of Africa now and we see a lot of straight lines in the boundaries between countries, and those have been faulted as being colonial superimpositions on something that really wasn't consistent with them. So after, it's been 50 years now, I guess, since the last colonial power really in Africa, after all that time, is there a validity to this notion of nation states in Africa?
Yeah, that's a great question. Nation states are clearly very young in Africa, and many of them in the sort of world of political science are described as failed states or dysfunctional states. So clearly the actual boundaries of contemporary African nations are impositions stemming in large part from the colonial period. But I think what's important, there's a couple important points to make here. One is that in terms of thinking about the validity of nationalism in Africa, one is that Europeans may have created these artificial constructs that became nation states, but the national movements that resulted in the end of colonial rule were informed by ideas that often stemmed from an African context. They drew on ideas from elsewhere, right? But the language that is used in these national movements, yes, it does sort of draw on European language as a way of challenging Europeans using their very own language. But in many cases, these languages of nationalism and practices of nationalism often stem from debates within African communities. So Europeans might have created the actual constructs, but Africans then filled them with ideas that were a combination of European languages and practices and more deeply rooted African practices. So it's a bit more complicated than just saying these are impositions stemming from the outside. It's some sort of combination of African and European ideas that are informing African nationalist movements. And the second important point, I think, to make is that it wasn't inevitable that African nationalism would be the sort of defining sort of political discourse during the period of decolonization. In the 1950s, there are a variety of political imaginations at play. So in other words, there wasn't a direct line from early anti-colonial resistance to sort of modern independent African nations. That is just too sort of simplistic of a historical story. There are a variety of political imaginations at play, and what scholars are now looking at is why particular avenues were shut down and others opened up in this very important period of the 1950s, because it didn't have to turn out the way it did. It's much more contingent than just sort of the straight teleological line. And this is sort of a new field of scholarship that is emerging now, and people are really beginning to focus in particular on this very sort of vibrant, important period in the 1950s, where there were many possibilities for the way things would turn out, and to figure out why some were closed down, others became more open.
And how much of a sense would you say there has been in East Africa in the 21st century of being part of all Africa? In other words, being aware of Nelson Mandela, being sort of linked to West Africa and feeling really like a continent as opposed to sort of a separate region.
And that would include North Africa for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is an interesting and somewhat complicated question. Some of the earliest leaders of independent African nations, including in East Africa, were very much sort of part of this Pan-African movement, right? In the 1960s, Jomo Kenyatta is a good example. Julius Nyerere, the first president of Tanzania, was very much sort of in working in the spirit of getting Africans to work together as Africans. As things became more problematic, beginning in most places in East Africa in the 1970s, this sense of solidarity, I think, really began to break down on a political level. But it's interesting, if you sort of spend some time in East Africa, some of these ideas really sort of come through in more informal contexts. So, for instance, I remember being in East Africa during the World Cup, and Africans in East Africa are always rooting for other African teams, even if they're in West Africa or North Africa. And it might seem, you know, sort of a little bit inconsequential, but I think perhaps it does relate to sort of a larger understanding that it might not be that we're all related, but the idea is that as Africans, we all face similar circumstances in common that in part are the result of a common history of colonialism. And therefore, Africans face similar cultural and political and economic and structural challenges that are historically connected, without saying that we somehow share some sort of racial commonality.
East Africa then has what to look forward to in the future? What are its strong suits?
There's an increasing effort to really bring together an East African community, similar sort of modeled on the European Union, let's say, which perhaps is not the best model at this point, but the beginnings of this, there used to be an East African community and it broke down, and they're trying to reinvigorate it to create a sort of open trade zone and a zone in which East Africans, people from Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania can travel sort of more freely from country to country for employment and trade and other purposes. I think there's a lot of political obstacles that still need to be overcome, but ultimately I think this would be a very good development, and it might sort of coincide with the increasing use, in fact, of Swahili in places like Uganda, where for a variety of reasons Swahili isn't spoken as commonly as in Kenya or Tanzania. But to have a common language is actually crucial. And English is one language in common, but to have an African language in common, I think, would be really sort of monumental for this region. And I'm hopeful in this respect that there will be increased cooperation, both on a political and an economic level in East Africa.
Our guest has been Neil Kodish. We've been talking about East African history. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.